Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Ham Nation is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of Ham Nation is brought to you by ICOM. En route, on location, on the go. Let ICOM help you take ham radio on the road. For more info, visit ICOMAmerica.com/hamnation and by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, visit audiblepodcast.com/hamnation. And by Ting.com. Ting is a mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting. Pay only for what you use. Ting doesn't require a contract and offers unlimited devices on one shared plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit hamnation.ting.com. That's hamnation.ting.com.
This is Ham Nation episode 137 for March 5th, 2014, the World Radio Sport Team Championship. Hi, and welcome to another episode of Ham Nation. Good to be back with you this week. Bob is out, but we've got a big show lined up for you tonight. Right now, let's bring in my buddy Don Wilbanks. Good evening, Don.
Hey, how you doing? Happy Mardi Gras to everybody. Now, I want Alex. Alex is driving the bus. I want you to be ready with the censored button because I have the Mardi Gras beads on, and you know how Gordon gets. There's a precedent for him taking his shirt off. So, happy Mardi Gras, everyone. Good to be here.
Yeah, happy Mardi Gras, Don. And Gordo, you're with us again this week. What's it like over on the West Coast now?
Well, we have finally dried out thanks to the weather. And boy, I tell you, a lot of things happening this Saturday in Ham Radio. Fan clubs of Ham Nation, the Mike and Key Club up in Puyallup, Washington at the Washington State Fairgrounds in Puyallup. They say Saturday, this Saturday the 8th, is their upcoming HamFest. Maine Trading, they say that in Paris, Texas, they will have more surplus stuff in their giant sellathon this Saturday. And coming up in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Ham Fest at Eau Claire, Wisconsin, this Saturday. And Charlotte, North Carolina, Kay Craigie from the American Radio Relay League is coming on down. And that is a Friday night, all day Saturday Ham Fest. Green County Ham Fest in Claremore, Oklahoma, thanks to Mark, KB0MOF. That is a Friday, Saturday. And you know, we really appreciate a Friday, Saturday, because that lets the exhibitors on Sunday get back to where they came from. And we think that Sundays are always sort of slow at Ham Fest. So we love Friday and Saturdays. And again, Mike and Key Club Saturday only this coming Saturday. And a week from Saturday, we'll be at Palm Springs for the Desert Rats Ham Fest on the 15th. So you never know who you'll see there. Maybe even Hannah and N3JF that we see on the show may be showing up. So, George, back to you. And I love your set.
Oh, thank you, Gordo. It took a lot of time to put this together. A lot of planning went into it. I had to kind of drug the chickens over here to keep them quiet. But
again?
I think we'll get through the evening, though. And, you know, we've been trying for several weeks now to get Steve in W7UDI, and I think we finally got him here. Steve, are you with us tonight?
Oh, yes, I am, George, and good evening to you and everyone at Ham Nation.
Well, good to see you. Tell us what your connection is with Ham Nation.
My connection is on the 20-meter net control. When Bill, I started helping Bill K5LN last year as assistant net control, and then Bill stepped away, and I took over the net control at about the time when the band started shutting down last fall, early winter, and been kind of keeping it alive. We've been getting a few check-ins every week, a little scattered here and there, a couple weeks without, but and then I'm revamping it right back up as conditions start to change for 20 meters, and we've been cooking along.
That's great. You know, 20 meters, when it's working, it's really hopping, so that's going to be a good net. What frequency are you trying to use? I know you kind of have to adjust it depending on what else is going on the band.
Typically, we're using 14-268, and then we'll go up and down 5 kilohertz or so, depending on where it is. But I usually try to stick around 268. That's where Bill set it up, and I'm going to stick with it, and we'll continue there. And if we have to change it, then we'll change it. But it's been working out pretty good for us so far.
Cool. You know, those that aren't hams, the frequency spectrum kind of changes throughout the day as the ionosphere cools and warms and changes height and one thing or another. And the different bands, like 20 meters, is a little higher frequency than our other nets on 40 and 75 meters. So that band kind of goes out first. This time of year, Steve, about how late is 20 meters usually usable?
Right now, the last few weeks, I've been seeing it cut out about 8 o'clock Pacific Coast time. Each week it gets a little bit longer and longer. It used to cut out around 7:30, and then the last couple of weeks it's been about 8 o'clock. And then so with the time change coming up this weekend, remember to change your clocks this weekend. I'm hoping it'll go to 9 o'clock West Coast time, and then we'll be able to, you know, have longer conversations, and we'll get more check-ins, and just that's the goal, and work as many people into it. It's 20 meters is a tough band. It's more of a spring, summer, fall band. In the wintertime, it just kind of changes. But, you know, we work it, we adapt, we overcome, and we move on, as we say here in the fire service.
Yeah. Gordo, have you got any questions for Steve?
No, I think he does a great job. Now, listen, when we go off on standard time to daylight or the other way around, whatever happens this Saturday night, Sunday morning, is that going to be better? I think it will, right?
Yeah, I think it's going to be better. It's always the band will start cutting out at 9 o'clock our time here on the West Coast, and then as the days get longer and longer, the band should stay in, and we'll be fine. So what I've done in the fall and now I'm doing is I do early check-ins. So what I'll do is once I'm done here, I'll get out there on 268, and if you want to check in chat room, if you want to check in and get it in. Get it done with me before the band shuts down, and then hop on down to 40 meters and check in with the guys over there. You get two for one.
Good deal.
That sounds great. All right, George, back to you.
Okay. Well, Steve, it's great to have you with us tonight, and we're going to be looking for you after the show on 14.268. And hopefully it'll hold in there and we can make contact tonight. I've checked in the 20-meter net before, but, you know, if the band's not there, it's just not there. Now, let me ask you before we go, what part of the country are you in, and what part can you hear when the band is open?
I'm here in the Pacific Northwest. I'm in a little town called Ellensburg, and we're halfway between Seattle and Spokane, and I call it drive-through country. It's because people that are going from Seattle to Spokane, they just drive through our town. We're just a gas stop, basically. So I pretty much hear most of the people in the U.S. It does pretty good. I've had pretty good success last year, and hopefully this coming year with trying to catch everybody. I am in the process. I built a new shop last summer, and I had to stop my tower construction for the winter, and I'm waiting for the ground to dry out a little bit, and then we'll get our tower up and our new beam, and that should help out. So right now we're just working along with a little Carolina Windham, and it does very well, believe it or not. I'm just super impressed with it, but I'm more or less a guy that likes resonant antennas, and when I can get my tuner out of the circuit, all the better. And so later this spring and summer, we'll be using the beam, and hopefully we'll be able to pick up more of the stations. I have been successful with the guys running QRP. So if you're running QRP, don't be scared about 20 meters. I mean, if I can hear you, I'll work you. So keep on trying on. And just check on in, and if you don't get me this week or you know 1 week, then come again next week, and we'll pull you in there and get you in the log.
All right, thanks, Steve. And yeah, you're in a perfect location to be running a beam. You're up there, kind of in the corner of the U.S., so you can swing that thing around and cover most of the U.S. from that location, and not worry about anything off to the sides or behind you very much. So that ought to be great. We're looking forward to hearing how the tower project goes there in the future. Thanks for all you do for Ham Nation and the other net controls. And we'll hopefully have you back on here soon and get a report after things start warming up on 20 meters.
You got it. Anytime.
All right, thanks. Right now, let's get a message from ICOM, and then we'll come back, and we've got some more exciting stuff going on tonight.
HF, VHF, or UHF, ICOM has you covered wherever you go. Check out the IC7410 and IC7200, two HF radios that employ ICOM's signature DSP technology. The IC7410 is an all-mode HF transceiver. It's got dual conversion super heterodyne system, a built-in auto tuner, and built-in 15 kHz first IF filter and optional 3 kHz and 6 kHz filters. The IC7200 offers solid performance and digital flexibility. It also includes selectable filter width and shape, excellent receiver performance, and it's compact and rugged, even with a water-resistant front panel. And when it comes to mobiles, have you considered the V8000 for your next adventure on 2 meters? It's got 75 watts of power output in a rugged die-cast aluminum chassis, fast memory channel scanning with dynamic memory scan, complete radio control in the palm of your hand with the versatile mic, backlight customization, and weather scan alert and amateur radio first. And let's not forget ICOM's line of D-Star handheld radios, too. The IC92AD is one rugged VHF-UHF dual bander. Its submersible construction can withstand harsh outdoor elements. Dual watch capability, a built-in voice recorder in DV mode, and optional GPS mic. It's great for MCOM and search and rescue. The IC80AD is another dual bander with extended receive coverage. It's the handheld companion to the ID880H mobile rig that I use, and it's an affordable option for hams interested in trying D-Star. It's durable and splash-proof, and it has NOAA weather radio pre-programmed. The UHF D-Star ID31A has so many features for on-the-go operation. It's got built-in GPS. It's compact and lightweight with waterproof construction. It's got a micro SD card slot and repeater list up for quick access to nearby D-Star repeaters. So make sure you visit ICOM America/HF-VHF-UHF for more information on ICOM's line of on-the-go radios.
And after each episode of Ham Nation, you can tune in to win. Go to ICOMAmerica.com/HamNation and register to win some great swag prizes from the ICOMSwagStore.com. But not only that, ICOM's giving away a radio every month. And for February, the prize was the IC80AD. And we've got a lucky winner on that now. That's Chris Cooper, AE9CC. Congratulations, Chris. ICOM will be getting that radio out to you in the next week or so. And we had so much fun giving away that one. Let's do it again. So for March, we're going to give away another IC80AD, dual band VHF, UHF handy talkie with 5 watts of output power, D-Star digital voice, wideband receive, and more. So go to ICOMAmerica.com/HamNation after the show today and throw your name in the hat. And now let's go on over to Gordo. Gordo, we've got another guest tonight, don't we?
We sure do. And, you know, I know all of you had been watching the Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia. Wow, what a great event. Well, you know, ham radio operators also have our Ham Radio Olympics. And tonight we have the chairman of the upcoming summertime Ham Radio Olympics, Doug Grant, K1 Delta Golf. Doug, tell us a little bit more about your upcoming Ham Radio Olympics. Doug, good to see you.
Hi, Gordo. Sure, Gordo. Great to see you. Great to be here. Well, the event is called the World Radio Sport Team Championship. Radio sport being a fancy way of saying radio contesting. And there are a lot of contests through the years, and they all have basically the same goal, to see who can make the most contacts in the most states, the most countries, whatever, in a short period like 24 hours. And they're usually unfair because some stations are on hilltops with great big antennas, and some guys are down in valleys with little tiny antennas. And it's a little difficult to compare the two stations like that and whether one operator is better than the other. So what the WRTC is a special contest where everybody goes to the same location, so nobody has an advantage of being on a hilltop or in a rare country. They all get identical antennas. They all operate with the same amount of power, usually 100 watts. And now all the variables in the competition are taken out except the operator skills. So it's a lot like the Olympics.
Wow, that's terrific. Now, Seattle back in 1990, as I recall, was the very first one. Where are the Olympics, ham radio Olympics from Seattle in 1990, Doug?
Well, the first one, you're right, was in 1990 in Seattle. And they did a terrific job there. They organized 14 countries being represented with 22 operating teams, two-man teams. And they had a just a terrific event. It was the first thing of its kind, and they really put on a great show. And it was decided then and there that it had to be a regular event. So after Seattle, the next one came up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I think we have a couple of pictures of that running around, Alex. But the there are some. The next one was in San Francisco in California. There we go, organized by the Northern California Contest Club and some other friends there. And you see some of the photographs of some of the competitors operating and some of the social events that took place. The next one was in Slovenia in 2000. Now, Slovenia is a little country in Europe. They say they're on the sunny side of the Alps. And it's true. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. You can see the lake right next to the town where we were all operating from. The next one was held in Finland in 2002, and again, it was a combination of radio competition and also a social event for all the people who came from around the world. Next one moved to South America. We all went to Brazil and had an absolutely terrific time there. It turns out resort hotels are readily available in July in Brazil because that's the winter time. So we had a great time there and a great competition. And then the most recent one was in Russia in 2010, and that was also a really terrific event.
Oh, that's terrific, Doug. Now, Doug, who decides where the Ham Radio Olympics will be held?
Well, there's an organizing committee called the WRTC Sanctioning Committee, and they accept bids from countries and organizations that think they're capable of hosting the event. There's a lot that goes into planning it, and that committee consists of the chairs of all the past WRTC events who evaluate the applications from the countries that want to host it and eventually choose the winners. So that's what happens. In 2010, we made a proposal from here in New England and eventually prevailed and got the hosting rights to the 2014 event.
Doug, I've got a question. Don here. You mentioned that like most contesting, everyone has different sites, different altitudes, different setups. But you say that everything is pretty much matched, and it makes everyone on a level playing field. How do you set up something like this to make sure that everyone is on a level playing field?
Well, that's a great question, and it's really a lot of work. What we've done is come up with a station design where all the stations are identical. Every station will be equipped with a 40-foot tower, a small tri-band Yagi. In fact, it's the Cycle 24 Yagi that I think you guys talked about last week that's now being sold by DX Engineering. Inverted Vs hanging off the tower for 80 and 40 meters. All the competitors are allowed to bring their own radios set to 100 watts output power. And we set them up field day style in a tent on relatively flat ground. So we don't put everybody on hilltops because it's hard to get equal hilltops. And nobody's in a valley. Everyone really has a pretty equal shot. This is an aerial view of one of the stations we used last year. One of the operators brought along his little quadcopter with a camera on it. So that's sort of an eagle eye view of the tower set up, and you see the tent over in the corner there, where the operators were set up with their radios. So the individual operators bring their own equipment, but we set them up. There's the Cycle 24 antenna. And you can see the feed points for the two wire antennas hanging off it.
Well, that really looks like a lot of fun, Doug. How are the teams chosen, and how many are there?
Well, it's very competitive to get into this thing. It's just like the Olympics. For the 4 years leading up to the event, we tracked the scores in every contest of everybody who competed, and we kept track of who was doing the best in each one of the geographic regions. Usually WRTC is around 50 teams or so. We have 59 representing all parts of the world. Each operator competed against all the other operators in his own region, and then we picked who the best of the best were. This time around, we're going to have more USA teams than ever before. We'll have a total of 14 teams from the U.S., so every call area is represented. These are the station locations where we'll be set up in Eastern Mass. The headquarters hotel is in the center, and the stations are where those red stars are set up in some of the towns, kind of on a diagonal line that is broadside towards Europe, where most of the contacts will come from. So we have 14 teams from the U.S., 27 from Europe, a smattering from the rest of the world, South America, the Caribbean, Canada, Africa, Asia. We have a youth team where the operators are both under 25 years old, a few sponsored teams, and it's a tradition that the defending champions from the previous WRTC get invited back automatically. So we'll have the champions from Russia, which was a Russian operating team, trying to defend their title.
So you're building 59 complete stations for this?
Well, we actually decided that we needed a few spares because you never know when one of them is going to come up with a problem with line noise or something, because it's either been too rainy or too dry or too whatever. So we're actually putting up a total of 65 stations, so we'll have 6 contingency spares in case something goes wrong with one of the first 59.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, who pays for all this, Doug?
Well, we're going to send you the bill, Gordo. We know how much money you make in this whole racket. So, actually, each WRTC has to come up with their own funding plan and do their own fundraising. We've been very fortunate. We've been very well supported with donations from individuals, clubs. Several of the manufacturers supported us, and they helped us out with a lot of the donations as well, other than money. Times Microwave, for example, donated all the coax, and when you add it all up, it was 6 miles of coax that they donated to us for free. So that was a big deal. And you can see the logos of some of the other sponsors, both commercial companies and foundations and organizations that have helped us out. But we have a little bit of advertising space on our website, but it's almost all come from donations and contributions. The clubs have turned out very well for us. These are the 10 sponsors. The page have their name put on the side of a tent, sort of NASCAR style. Both USA clubs and DX clubs have all contributed. Our current fundraising program is to pay for the team village, where a club or a group can fund a room at the team village where all the competitors will be staying and eating. And you can see that some of the clubs have even sponsored multiple rooms at the team village. So it's been terrific to see the support we've got.
Wow, that's terrific, Doug. Now, who decides winner, winner, winner? Who gets to make that decision?
Well, we have a log checking committee that, as soon as the contest is over, collects all the computerized logs from all the competing stations. Then they download the logs that are sent in from the stations offsite who are competing. WRTC takes place inside the IARU Radio Sport, which is an annual contest that is very, very popular. So we cross-check all the contacts, look for copying errors, and take out any errors and duplicates and any other problems, recompute the score, and then the winners will be declared at the closing ceremony, Olympic style, at the end of the event. It's really a big race. These guys will make 3,000 or 4,000 contacts in 24 hours using fairly simple antennas and just 100 watts.
Wow! So you issue gold, silver, and bronze medals, a great corollary to the actual Olympics. I can just imagine the excitement it would be to stand up there on the podium and represent your country and get a World Radio Sport medal. Have you been a competitor yourself?
Yeah, actually, I have. I've competed in 5 of these WRTCs, including the first one out in Seattle, and I've been very fortunate operating with very good partners and getting the luck of the draw in pretty good stations and. This is actually, I figured you might ask that question. Whoops, let me go over this side. There we go. That's the gold medal that I won in Seattle for first place operating with my brother-in-law, K1AR.
Nice.
So we had a great time. It's a great time. Besides the competitors, everyone has a good time there, making and renewing friendships with contesters I've talked to for long years. But it's not just for the winners, not just for the guys who are active on site. Obviously, people outside the event get to contact all the competing stations and be part of it. We'll have a live scoreboard running so you can track how your favorite team is doing. We're using the sports side of ham radio to attract some interest from the media. So we're hoping that we'll get a lot of press coverage, both locally and nationally, for the whole event.
That is awesome. How can we find out more about the events if say we want to get our RDF skills and stuff together for the games in the next 4 years?
Well, we've got a website right there underneath my name, right there, www.wrtc2014.org. There's a short video there that gives a little bit of background on what the event is all about and what we're doing here in New England for it, and a lot of information on how the teams are selected. And as we go forward, getting closer to July when the event occurs, we'll have a lot more information about where to look for the stations, what bands they'll probably be on, and how you can work them and how you can play in the game.
Oh, wow.
That is,
well, Doug,
that is just
thank
the coolest
you so
thing.
Much for joining all of us tonight on Ham Nation. K1 Delta Golf. We'll be listening for your call and all of the stations that are on the air. Thanks, Doug, for joining us, and we'll be tuning in this summer. Don, back to you.
Thanks a lot, Doug. That was great. I've heard of the World Radio Sports stuff, but I don't know. I had something completely different in mind, so that was some great light shedding for me. That's good stuff. I want to talk to you about a sponsor now of Ham Nation, and that is Audible.com. I love Audible.com because it's audiobooks. You know, I've got a long commute every day to and from work, 125 miles round trip. And yeah, I've got satellite radio in my car, and I like to listen to that, and I like to listen to the local traffic stuff, but sometimes you need to just escape. And that's what Audible is all about. Audible is the leading provider of audiobooks, more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, fiction, nonfiction, periodicals, and for listeners of Ham Nation, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out the service. One audiobook you might consider is maybe the one that I'm reading right now. Let me pull it up on my iPhone here because that's how I listen to Audible on my iPhone. I've gotten into a Stephen King bend here lately, and right now, it is scary. It is very scary. The one I did before this one was The Stand, and they have two versions of The Stand. They have the original version, and then they have an extended version, which was stuff that was actually taken out, and it was like, I don't know, but it's like 50 hours long. The it is very, very long as well. I think I'm on my fourth or fifth Stephen King book now, and I've just kind of gotten into a Stephen King bend. But they have everything. They got Stephen King. They've got fiction, nonfiction, like I say, everything that you would want to hear for the most part. Yeah, look at that. 47 hours and 52 minutes long. Isn't that great? I love it. Look up and see. Yeah, there's The Stand. That's the, 47 hours for that. Is that the, I think that's the original one. That's not the extended one where they had all the stuff that, like 5,000 words that they cut out of the original one went into the, to the extended one, but just great stuff. And I've really been getting into the Stephen King stuff. So if you're a Stephen King fan and the people who are reading this are really, really great voice actors. I mean, they get into it. It's almost like listening to a play. You can download The Stand or It or anything else for free, or any other book of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/hamnation. audiblepodcast.com/hamnation. There's just a small percentage of the book of the 150,000 titles that aren't eligible for the free trial offer. And so far, I've not come across anything that I haven't wanted to read that isn't on there. So, the free trial gives you one credit. And you can select, and like I said, 99.5% of the books are all one credit. Even if you look on those things like The Stand was expensive. But when you sign up, you're going to be signing up for the gold package, and that's $15 a month. And no matter what it costs, I think The Stand was like a $45 or $50 book, and it was $15. It's what it costs me every month. So check on audible.com and check it out and make sure that it's there. But anyway, it's great stuff. You're absolutely going to love Audible.com, and thank you so much, Audible, for being a sponsor of Ham Nation. Again, it's audiblepodcast.com slash Ham Nation. I think you'll be as happy with Audible as I am, and I absolutely love it. I mean, I seriously love Audible.com. Thanks for being a sponsor. Let's see what's going on with the news of the week now from the Amateur Radio Newsline. From Amateur Radio Newsline Report, number 1907, these are the Ham Nation headlines for Wednesday, March 5th, 2014. An Ohio town is appealing the state's PRB1-like law after it lost an appeal by a ham who was given the right to put up an antenna that the municipality denied. On February 4th, the village of Swanton, Ohio, filed a notice of appeal of its intention to challenge the decision of the Fulton County Common Pleas Court in the case of Gary Watke versus the village of Swanton. Here's Amateur Radio Newsline Stephen Kinford, N8WB.
The legal issue began when the village denied Gary Watke's tower application, and Watke, who holds the call WW8N, appealed that decision to the Fulton County Common Pleas Court. The court ruled in favor of Watke, telling the village that it must approve a variance to WW8N's antenna support structure. Instead, the village is now appealing that order. In its docketing statement, the village of Swanton asserts four potential issues, including one that questions whether revised code section enacted by HB 158, which is Ohio's version of the federal PRB-1 statute, is constitutional. It also questions whether HB 158 was constitutionally applied in this case. Late word is that ARRL has announced its intention to file a friend of the court brief on behalf of Watke. This is likely because of the long-term potential a finding against WW8N might hold by impacting on any ham living anywhere in the United States. WW8N is represented by Toledo attorney Kerry Cooper and by Fred Hopengarten, K1VR. Hopengarten is considered a national authority on zoning law and amateur radio antenna issues.
If you're wondering about the strange band conditions the past few days, our home star may be the culprit. According to spaceweather.com, sunspot AR1967 returned to the earthward-looking side of the sun February 25th and promptly erupted. This sent an X4.9-class solar flare headed our way. So far, this is the strongest flare of the year and one of the strongest of the current solar cycle. We suggest you keep an eye on spaceweather.com for updates about solar activity and its effect on radio propagation. The 2014 Global Amateur Radio Emergency Conference will be held this year just prior to the Huntsville Hamfest in Huntsville, Alabama. Here's Hal Rogers, K8CMD.
The conference will take place August 14th and 15th at the Embassy Suites Hotel, which is adjacent to the convention venue at the Von Braun Convention Center. The Hamfest will immediately follow on the weekend of August 16th and 17th. Planners of the 2014 Global Amateur Radio Emergency Conference say that all emergency communication-minded amateurs and professional planners from all around the world are invited to attend. The conference agenda, full information, and a website are currently being developed.
GARIC 2013 was held in Zurich, Switzerland. This is the second time the Huntsville Hamfest has hosted GARIC. The last time was 2007. The Huntsville Hamfest is the ARRL Southeastern Division Convention and has been designated as a 2014 regional ARRL Centennial event. More on the Huntsville Hamfest is online at hamfest.org. And for nearly 20 years, the Huntsville Hamfest has been the home of Amateur Radio Newsline's Young Ham of the Year Award. For full details on that, please see our website, www.arnewsline.org. Just click on the YHOTY button. Planning is now underway for the 2014 National Hurricane Conference slated for April 14th to the 17th at the Orlando Hilton Hotel in Orlando, Florida. Here's Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF.
The primary focus of this gathering is to improve preparedness, response, recovery, and mitigation regarding severe tropical weather in order to save lives and property in the United States and the tropical islands of both the Caribbean and the Pacific. The meeting also serves as a national forum for federal, state, and local officials to exchange ideas and recommend new policies to improve various aspects of emergency management. There is a good reason to expect a strong amateur radio and ARES presence in the form of workshops, discussions, and forums.
You'll find complete details online at hurricanemeeting.com. Wilson County, North Carolina Auxiliary Emergency Communications was activated for the February 12th severe winter weather after weather officials began to predict a potential crippling ice storm for the Wilson County area. Again, here's Hal Rogers.
A number of team members manned the radio room at the Wilson County Emergency Operations Center, from where they provided weather reports of precipitation changes to Skywarn operations. Journal entry logs to the web, EOC, were posted to the Internet, and the Wilson County Auxiliary Emergency Communications Facebook page was updated with alerts and weather information. At one point, the group's social media page was reaching over 700 citizens in both the county and the city.
By the way, the first day of spring is March 20th. And that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline, your independent source for amateur radio news, brought to you each and every week for over 35 years and counting at www.arnewsline.org. I'm Don Wilbanks, AE5DW73. We'll see you next time here on Ham Nation.
Finished with Mardi Gras, and I've got this handful of beads. The next big parade coming up is going to be, for me anyway, the Irish-Italian parade. And I'll probably wear my kilt to that, but I'm thinking maybe for the Irish-Italian parade, or at least for next Mardi Gras, maybe we could take some make a Ham Nation. We should have a Ham Nation parade. We could get some ribbon cable, and we could stick some components in there, like some resistors and some inductors, maybe some diodes. And at the bottom, instead of, you got this big medallion here for Toth, maybe we could, like, get an 807 tube or something and fill it full of LEDs. Maybe put a little button battery in there to make it glow. So it wouldn't be hot and it wouldn't singe the hair off our chest. that goes on Gordon's picture.
Oh, my God.
Speaking of diodes, I think that's what you're talking about in Smoke and Solder tonight, isn't it?
It is, Don. You know, we've talked about some electronic components in the past. We haven't covered diodes yet, so tonight seems like the perfect opportunity.
A diode is a device with asymmetrical conductance. It has low resistance to current in one direction and high resistance in the other. A semiconductor diode is the most common type today. It's a piece of semiconductor material with a PN junction connected to two electric terminals. A vacuum tube diode has two electrodes, a plate, which is the anode, and a heated cathode. Semiconductor diodes were the first semiconductor electronic devices. The discovery of crystals' rectifying abilities was made by German physicist Ferdinand Braun in 1874. The first semiconductor diode is called a cat's whisker diode. It was developed around 1906 and is made of mineral crystals like galena. Today, most diodes are made of silicon, but other semiconductors such as selenium or germanium are sometimes used. The most common function of a diode is to pass an electrical current in one direction. That's called the diode's forward direction. The diode blocks current in the opposite direction, and this is called the reverse direction. The diode's action is called rectification. It's used to convert alternating current to direct current. It's also used for extraction of modulation from radio signals in receivers. Due to the nonlinear current voltage characteristics, diodes can have more complicated behavior than the simple on-off action. Semiconductor diodes start conducting electricity only when a certain threshold voltage or cut-in voltage is present in the forward direction. This is called forward bias. The voltage drop across a forward bias diode varies only a little with the current and is affected by temperature. This effect can be used as a temperature sensor or as a voltage reference. Semiconductor diodes' current-to-voltage characteristics can be tailorized by varying the semiconductor material and doping, which is introducing impurities into the material. These are used for special-purpose diodes that perform many different functions. For example, Zener diodes are used to regulate voltage. Avalanche diodes are used to protect circuits from high-voltage surges. Variactor diodes are used to electrically tune radio and TV receivers. Tunnel diodes have negative resistance, which makes them useful in some types of circuits. And light-emitting diodes, or LEDs, produce light. Vacuum tube diodes, which are also called thermionic diodes, and solid-state or semiconductor diodes, were developed separately at approximately the same time in the early 1900s. They were used as radio detectors. Until the 1950s, vacuum tube diodes were more often used in radio because the early point contact type semiconductor diodes, the cat whisker detectors, were less stable. Also, because most receiving sets had vacuum tubes for amplification anyway, and they could easily have diodes included in the tube. Vacuum tube rectifiers and gas fill rectifiers handle some high voltage, high current rectification tasks beyond the capabilities of semiconductor diodes at the time. Now let's look at some more practical aspects of diodes. First, the diode symbol is like this. If we put a positive voltage in on this end, a positive voltage comes out on the other end. Now, you notice the arrow is drawn in this direction. We know now that electrons, or the negative portion of a charge, is what actually travels through a wire. So why is the arrow going in the wrong direction? Well, the story I got is that at the time they came up with the diode symbol, they thought that the positive charge is the one that flowed.
Oh!
So now let's connect the diode and see if it actually does what it's supposed to. We'll just take a standard diode here and a 9-volt battery. And we'll connect the positive terminal of the battery to the anode side of the diode. And that's the side without the ring on it. And we'll connect it to a meter. Our negative terminal to the meter will go to the negative of the battery. First, we'll check right here just at the voltage going into the diode. And we see this battery is measuring around 9.39 volts. Now, let's measure it through the diode. 9.13. That means we lost 0.2 volts through the diode here, and that's pretty typical. Now let's reverse the polarity of the diode and see if it actually blocks the voltage from going through. And it pretty much does. There's a little bit of voltage remaining there, 0.06, and that's to be expected too. There's a little bit of reverse flow in most diodes. Now what we've done so far is just connected to a DC source, a battery. Now let's try an AC source. This is a transformer with a center tap on it. What that means is we'll have a voltage potential across the two outer leads here, and the center tap lead from either side will be one half of what the two outer leads are. That's not important for our experiment. I just thought I would talk about it. So first, let's measure the AC voltage across the two secondary leads here. And we're measuring approximately 11.2 volts. Let's put our meter on DC and see what we've got. 0 volts. That's because this is a transformer. It puts out AC, not DC. Now let's put a diode in series with all of this and see what happens. Now we're measuring about 4.63 volts. So we do have some DC voltage here, and that's being produced here by the diode, because it's only allowing the positive half of this AC wave to go through. That's a little less than half of the AC voltage that we actually have here on the two secondary leads. But that's what you'd expect, because you're only rectifying half of the waveform, and there's a little loss in the diode itself. So how do you get around this? Well, we could put another diode in series with the other side here, but that's not really going to do anything, because it's still only going to allow one half of that cycle to get through. To get more of the complete AC voltage here out as DC, we'll use what's called a bridge rectifier configuration. Now what this is four diodes connected around in a circle in a particular polarity. We have two of the cathodes here going to one terminal, and we've got two of the anodes going to the other terminal, and then we've got off the side here one anode and one cathode connected. So if we put an AC signal in on the two ends of this bridge, we're going to get a positive signal up here at the top, and we're going to get a negative here at the bottom. So here's how it works. If you think of the positive charges flowing, which is really not true, but that's how I generally think about a diode. When the AC voltage swings positive here, that's going to allow positive out to this terminal through this diode. When the other side of the AC signal swings positive, that's going to go out through this diode. And then the negatives are just down here on the bottom. So now we're using both halves of that waveform to get a voltage out. So let's see how that works. This is a bridge rectifier
already in a package. There's four diodes in here. You can see there's two terminals labeled with a waveform. That's where you put in the AC. And then the negative and the positive DC are on these corners. Now we've got 9.82 volts, approximately twice what we had when we were only rectifying one side of the waveform here. So that's the reason a bridge rectifier is so popular, and you can find those in a lot of different style of packages. Well, I hope you've learned a little bit about diodes today. There's a lot more to it, but this is just a basic introduction to kind of show you the theory of how they work. Well, there you go. We'll cover some more components in the future. Now let's get on into our contest. I've got to fess up here. I made a mistake a couple of weeks ago. I'd asked the question what type of third-party message from another country may be transmitted by an amateur station, and I had said the answer was any message, as long as the amateur operator's not paid. Wrong. I was looking at the question pool, and they have up at the top in little parentheses letters to tell you what the correct answer is. And I looked up there and I saw C, which meant something else. I didn't see the A sitting there. So the correct answer to that was only messages relating to amateur radio or remarks of a personal character or messages relating to emergencies or disaster relief. Now, last week I asked the question, an inductor is often called a choke or a coil. What's another name that's common for an inductor that might be used in an AM transmitter? And I had a winner on that. It came from Gerald Pemberton, K0IKZ. And he said, I think the answer you're looking for is a reactor. It's been a long time since I've heard that term. And that's correct, Gerald. And congratulations. You're going to win this copy of the Howell Amateur Radio Handbook. We'll be getting that out to you this week. And next week's question, we got another one of these MFJ 24-hour clocks here to give away. If you'd like to win that, then submit your answer to hamnationcontest@gmail.com and tell me, what's another name for a diode? And if you think you know, hamnationcontest@gmail.com. And Dale is out this week, but fortunately, we've got our friend Dan Van Evenhoven standing by to take his place this week. Dan?
Well, good evening. And now we're going to get into the videos right away. I'm starting my series of HF mobile, and we're going to get into mounts, which is the second video in the series. Go ahead and roll that.
This video is HF mobile mounts. A decent HF mobile antenna is not an inexpensive commodity, and many cost upwards of $1,200, although most are about half that. Assuming you spend this much for yours, why would you mount it in an inefficient manner? Yet this is the case 90% of the time. It pays to remember that antenna efficiency is a balancing act between various system losses. Even 1 ohm of additional losses can make a significant difference in signal strength on both ends of the contact. Thus, the antenna should be attached in such a way to maximize what little ground plane the vehicle represents. A key phrase here is, it's the metal mass directly under the antenna, not what's alongside that counts. Another often overlooked requirement is what side of the vehicle should the antenna be mounted on. It should be easy to view the antenna from the rearview mirror. Minivans, SUVs, RVs, Jeeps, station wagons, and crossovers are all vehicles that present a special case. Except for front mounting, the bodies of these vehicles shadow a large portion of the antenna. This causes tuning problems and reduces efficiency, which is already poor at best. If shadowing can't be avoided, then make sure the coil is as far away from the sheet metal as possible to minimize coil losses. Maximizing what little ground plane a vehicle offers is a worthwhile endeavor, and bonding is part of the solution, as well as mounting height. As we raise an HF antenna from low on the bumper toward the roof, the resonant frequency decreases. Part of this decrease is due to a decrease in ground loss. However, capacitive coupling between the antenna and the surface under the vehicle causes most of the effect. The change in resonance is typically between 1% and 3%. These factors will also cause a decrease in the input impedance, which is a good thing, even though the unmatched SWR might increase. So let's talk about some mounts. The big problem with mag mounts that you should be aware of is their ground losses. If you think attaching a ground strap to the nearest hard point on your vehicle will help negate the situation, you're wrong. There are two other problems with mag mounts. First, they collect road debris, which eventually will get between the sheet metal and the magnet. Secondly, the base cover, usually rubberized plastic, has an affinity for clear coat vehicle finishes.
years.
It is a given that the surface under the mag mount will both scratch the surface and or discolor it over time. In some cases, less than a week. The bottom line is, if you have to resort to a mag mount for your antenna, you haven't thought long enough about other safer, more efficient mounting methods. Most ball mounts nowadays aren't worth the effort. If you find an old one, like the cast iron GE Master ball mount, is an excellent choice. They're probably the strongest one ever made. Unlike the newer ones, they're more accurately made. There are several things to keep in mind when using a non-permanent mount, no matter how it attaches. First, it's no better than the vehicle substructure it's clamped to. A typical example is a roof rack. Most are not DC grounded to the body of the vehicle. Even when they are, they still represent a very poor ground plane, even for UHF. Now we're going to get into the hard mounts. Pocket mounts are great for pickups. They're sturdy enough for just about any antenna and are adaptable for 3/8 24, SO239, NMO, and screwdriver mount fittings. They allow the coax to go out the bottom of the stack and in most cases are designed stronger than the stack itself. Post mounts are very handy for mounting antennas on flat surfaces like a truck bed or side rail. However, extending them to place the antenna higher is counterproductive, as doing so greatly increases the ground losses. It is not uncommon to see an antenna mounted top extended posts. This is an incorrect way of mounting an antenna, as the post raises the antenna above the ground plane, hence increasing losses. If you plan on using a trailer hitch mount, here's a suggestion. Have a second hitch ball receiver welded on the left end of the hitch. Then a short chunk of square tubing may be used as the actual mount, and it's easy to remove when necessary. One very important thing to remember about trailer hitch mounts, in the terms of efficiency, it's in one of the most least desirable locations. And contrary to popular opinion, running a ground strap to the frame will not negate this fact. My favorite is a homebrewed mount. They're really not that difficult to make. The best thing to use for a homebrewed mount is either stainless steel or galvanized pipe and Delrin plastic, which is virtually RF transparent up to the SHF range. A main drawback is cost, as Delrin is pretty expensive, about $100 per square foot. It's also a very slick plastic, so be careful when you drill it. It's almost as slick as Teflon. One last thing. Most HF antennas, a spring or a guy is a prerequisite. Some people prefer springs. Some people prefer guys. Some people prefer both. I've always guided my HF mobile antennas, usually with an inexpensive bungee cord. And if all else fails, talk to a mobile electronics certified professional or an ASE certified mechanic about your ham radio installation. Okay, that's on HF mounts. And like I always tell people, there's no such thing as an efficient HF mobile operation. So we try to get as close as we can. The second video is, everybody knows that the easiest contact to make on HF is when you hear a female voice. The second video that we have is the Young Ladies Radio League. They submitted this short little video, and when you listen to the video, you'll hear in the background the HF contacts, and I picked out about three or four calls. Go ahead.
Nearly 75 years after the fateful question of are there any YLs out there, the answer is a resounding, the YLs are out there and active. Ethel Smith started an organization that has outlasted its founding mothers, but it's still going strong with members all over the world. Though none of the original 12 founding mothers are no longer with us, there is still at least one member who has earned 64 years of continuous membership and another with 63. A handful of members have 50 to 55 years of continuous membership as well. Members are from all walks of life, all ages, and all levels of ham radio interest, whether they got into the hobby, talk to their spouse locally, or go around the world to the strangest of places. The one radio interest they have in common is other YLs. Members of the Young Ladies Radio League can be found at ham fests all over the world. YLRL members have tables with YLRL themed merchandise, past issues of YL harmonics, certificate information, and brochures. You may also find YLRL members at these events presenting at a YL forum as well. Themes can be anything from the YLRL and its history to local YL clubs and what YLs are currently doing in amateur radio. Every year at the Dayton Hamvention in Dayton, Ohio, the Young Ladies Radio League, Inc. and the Buckeye Bells Local Ohio Young Ladies Club share a table to greet young ladies in attendance. The YLRL also moderates a young ladies forum at the event.
And that's the Young Ladies Radio League video. The ham site of the week is the Cuyahoga Amateur Radio Society, submitted by Tom, WB8N. It's a local club that's in the Cleveland, Ohio area. They run three repeaters and are very active in many facets of ham radio, including including public service. That's and they're at www.2cars.org. www.2cars.org. And now I guess it's on to Don.
Well, thanks, Dan. Awesome stuff. I particularly enjoyed the mounts. I'll tell you what I use on my Jeep. I've got a Jeep Wrangler, and I mounted them, mounted my antennas. I wish I had pictures. I've got them on my Facebook page. But there's a company called Arizona Rocky Road, and they make a right angle mount, and it's welded metal. It's really, really strong, and it goes right where the windshield attaches to the body. And so it's like right at the back edge of the hood. So I've got it's almost right in the middle of the vehicle. So I've got metal fore and aft, and it's up kind of high. The only thing that's really up above that would be the roll bar and the windshield frame. But it works really, really good on both the VHF, UHF stuff, and on the little Tar Heel too that I use. So Arizona Rocky Road, if you've got a Jeep, they make some really, really good antenna mounting solutions. So
yeah, very good mounting places online that you can get custom mounts, and my understanding is DX Engineering is going to get into that little realm too.
But oh, sure.
Yeah, some of the custom mounting that you see out there is actually better than the off-the-shelf stuff. In my case, I actually mount mine to the side of the trailer hitch assembly under the vehicle. Okay. It's got four bolts that actually basically bolt in the same holes as the trailer hitch, and it comes up from there. So gives me a nice ground plane. Most people think the ground plane is on top of the vehicle, and you'd be incorrect if you thought that, because it's actually at the bottom of the vehicle.
Good stuff. Yeah, the best mount is the one that you make, because that way you make it specifically for your needs. You're not having to take something and maybe cobble it together. So good stuff. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate you being on here tonight. Let's talk about Ting. Let's talk about cell phones. Let's talk about Sprint. Now, Ting is related to Sprint, kind of, sort of. They're what's called an MVNO. That means they are a reseller of the nationwide Sprint network. And Sprint's got a pretty serious network, so you know it's going to be good stuff. So if you're happy with Sprint, you're going to love Ting. Here's the cool thing about Ting that makes it different from everybody else. Unlimited devices on one plan. Have as many devices as you want. On one plan, you're going to share the pooled minutes, messages, and megabytes. Every device on the plan just costs a flat $6 a month. And the rates just got better because Sprint gave them better pricing. And they're going to share the savings directly with you, the customer. Nothing fancy, no BS, just better rates, lower monthly bills for everyone. And if you've already tried the Ting savings calculator, go online, see how much you could save with Ting. It might be worth it to do it again to see how much more you could be saving. And as always, Ting has no contracts. You only pay for what you use each month with the megabytes, the messages, and the minutes all billed separately. That includes your voicemail, caller ID, tethering, hotspot, three-way calling, call forwarding, everything else that you like with your current plan you can have with Ting. The only thing different is you're going to be paying less money. And also, there's no contracts. There's no early termination fees. So they'll even give you a credit if you're having to pay an early termination fee to come over to Ting. You'll get a 25% credit of your ETF up to $75 per device just for going to Ting. You'll find details on that at ting.com/ETF. And you're charged only for what you use, plus whatever taxes Ting is legally required to collect. And that's it. No hidden charges, no recovery fees, no BS, no weird line item things that you're wondering, what is all this about? You take total control of your account, your usage, and your bills with a powerful online control panel. And if you do need to talk to someone, 1-855-TING-FTW is available 12 hours a day, anytime, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. A real live person will pick up the phone and help you. And, of course, you can roll to your own help, so to speak, at help.ting.com. Active customer support forums, a simple and powerful help ticketing system, video tutorials, startup guides, everything you need. Here's how it works. You purchase your mobile device from Ting. You'll get it in 2 to 5 business days. Or if you've got a phone that you really like say a Sprint phone, the iPhone 4, the 4S, you can bring that over to Ting. You can see the full list of eligible phones by going to the show special URL. Click on the BYOD, bring your own device link at the top of the page. There it is right there. Ting will even help you turn your old device into cash. They help with the move to Ting. After you activate your device with Ting, you'll have the option to select a new number or port your existing one. You've got that really cool phone number. You don't want to have to remember a new one. Bring your old one over. Ting will break out your rates by minutes, text messages, and megabytes. You'll get your bill at the end of the month for what you've used, and that is it. Hamnation.ting.com is where you want to go. You'll save money. You'll better manage your mobile phone usage with Ting. Check out the savings calculator. See how much you or your company can save. And because you're a Ham Nation viewer, oh, you lucky dog. You get $25 on your first Ting device when you sign up. Hamnation.ting.com. Start saving today. Ting, thank you so much for your support of Ham Nation. Let's see what Cheryl's got going in the chat room. Hey, Cheryl, is it cold up there? What are we at? 52 down here in Mississippi right now.
Hi, Don. You are so lucky at 52. You know, our wind chill factor is down to 8 degrees tonight, but we're supposed to get 40 pretty soon after 5 inches of snow earlier today. Wow.
You know, so, we had the coldest Mardi Gras on record yesterday. I think it was 37, 36. 37 was the record. I don't think we got above 37 yesterday, and that's the coldest Mardi Gras on record down here. And that's pretty chilly for New Orleans.
Right, right. Now, what did you do? Call me up and say, are you wearing white tonight? I don't know how we did this, but I'll tell you what here. I do have some things in here from the chat room just for you, so let's start with that.
All right.
I have W0TJP, Tim. He says, ask Don how he can concentrate on the show while wearing all those beads. Show me your beads because I've got my Mardi Gras beads on right here. Where are yours? You don't have them on. I wanted to ask you about it.
Show you my what? Oh, beads. Sorry. I got used to hearing something. I got used to hearing something different. Right. These are just a few. I only went to one parade this year because it was rainy and
in the 30s,
and I didn't do anything yesterday. I didn't even get out of the house hardly yesterday. But this is just a few, and this is from one of the parades. This is from the Toth Parade. It's spelled T-H-O-T-H. You don't pronounce it Thoth. It's Toth. It's hard to see with the glare, but anyway, Mardi Gras was this was my 30th Mardi Gras.
Wow! And
so I loved it. Love it.
Sounds like you had a wonderful time. That's great. And
always do.
One other thing from one of our guests in the chat room, R. Faust, I believe. It's K-I-4-T-T-Z. He says, ask Don the best way to listen to AR Newsline podcast on an iPhone. Do you have any recommendations, Don?
Yeah, if you go to arnewsline.org, I think all the information is there. You can it's available in iTunes, I think, or any of your other podcast thing. We can have it. Yeah, I think it is available in iTunes. You can have it just dropped into your iPhone every week. It'll automatically update. All the details should be on arnewsline.org.
Very good. Very good. Sounds like a plan. Thank you very much for the answer. And thanks for your segment, too. You do a great job on that, Don. So thanks for your wearing white, too. All right. So let's see here. I also have a comment for you, George, if you're there, from VE3MIC. Over to you, George.
Yeah, I'm here, Cheryl. I've got a few minutes. I got to go gather eggs. So,
cool.
Yeah, what's Mike's comment? I know he's up to something no good.
Absolutely. You absolutely got that right. So, VE3MIC, Mike says, look at those burn marks on George's alligator test leads. Now, how did you get those burn marks in the first place? That's what we want to know.
Those burn leads were hard to come by. No, actually, they're so old, they've just kind of discolored. I don't know what that's about. But anyway, they still work, and no one's gotten injured yet.
Well, that just goes to show you that everybody really is watching very intently for what you do. And there was many nice comments on there complimenting you and all that you do. And we thank you for all that. So a fine, fine job from Mr. Smoke and Solder. We really do appreciate you. And also, let's go over to California and say hi to Mr. El Gordo. How are you, Gordo, tonight?
Well, I am fine. And Don, oh, thanks, Don. I appreciate the beads.
You caught 'em.
So, Sharon, we're doing fine, and I see you've got your own beads from Don as well. Go ahead.
Okay, there's some questions in here. Looks like I can dig down in the chat room mailbag here. So to work DX like Europe, let's say, on 10 meters, what polarization should my converted CB three-element beam be?
Okay, that's a great question. Polarization on skyways is constantly changing. So if you've got a three-element CB beam that you've cut a few inches off of each of the elements, whether it's vertical or horizontal, you're going to do just fine. So polarization via skyways, not a big deal because it's constantly rotating.
Okay, very good. And thank you for that answer. And here's another one for you, Gordo. And then they'll be followed by the third. I have owned several newer solid-state HF transceivers, and my Daiwa watt meter seldom shows more than 70 watts on normal modulation. The radios are advertised as 100 watts PEP output. Why the 30-watt difference? Can you shed some light on that?
That's a good one. Most transceivers, 200 watts in, 100 watts out, about 50% efficient. Mm-hmm. But those are peak envelope power watts. When we talk about average watts, which you see on a hello on your meter, it's going to go up to about 70 watts average. So unless you have one of the more sophisticated peak reading watt meters, likely the average output will hover around 70 on voice peaks, which if you multiply by 1.414 would be about 100 watts peak. So that's normal to see 70 watts normal modulation.
Oh, very good, very good. And I have one answer I'm going to give and field the question here to someone in the chat room, and I have one final one for you to finish with, Gordo. So let me just do this one for Dean245. He's a potential new ham radio operator coming up to take the test this weekend, and we wish you all the best. But he did ask this, and I had the same problem when I first got on. He says he'll be taking his tech test this weekend. And he wanted to know some suggestions for a person who's mic shy. Now, believe it or not, everybody, I have to tell you here that would have been me when it came to getting on HF way back in the day. Well, not that far ago, but if it wasn't for David, you know, he was saying, oh, come on. I was kind of shy. So my recommendations are this. I would definitely listen out a lot to see how people go back and forth with how they return. I've learned a lot of things just from the listening aspect of it. But remember, ham radio operators usually don't bite when they know that you're a newer ham, and they'll be out there. And I would suggest even listening, if you have the capability to get on to 75 meters, listen to 3850, something like that, to see how people go back and forth between each other or any of the bands, really. Even 20 meters is quite nice, and get the hang of it just by listening. And when you do get in there, you just are going to be yourself. That's all I can say. And don't feel like, you know, it's any kind of apprehension. That's all I can say. And I was going to ask you, Gordo, you know, this is just as an adjunct to what I'm saying, is do you have any other suggestions for someone who might be mic shy?
I agree with you, Cheryl. Do a lot of listening. And on VHF, UHF, when you hear someone on the repeater saying monitoring, that means they're ready for a friendly conversation. Or on HF, if they say CQ, CQ, go back to that station that's sending out the very friendly CQ, and you'll find that station will realize you're new on the air and will bait you into a great conversation.
That's true. And then David taught me originally to say CQ, 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 75 meters. CQ, 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 75 meters. This is Kilowatt 9, Bravo, India, Kilo, over and by. This is K9BIK, and then they'll come back to you. But there's kind of a different way of doing it, but you'll pull them in. It'll be a lot of fun for you, and lots of luck on that test, by the way. And the final question for you, Mr. West, we have, and it comes from me, actually. If I want to run a second radio from Studio B, a B standing for bedroom, and I do want to transmit and listen on the same frequency as my Studio A station on HF, Although I know I'll have to run a separate mystery antenna, well, I want the same kind, which I already have, yet should my antenna be on the other side of the property to cause less interference? Is this even feasible, or am I looking for a disappointment? What can you recommend?
Well, no, you're looking for a blown-up radio if your antennas are too close. So if you're going to be monitoring on the same frequency as a 100-watt radio in the other room with your own individual antenna, you're going to have to turn your RF gain way down, make sure preamp is off. And after the other local station gets through transmitting, it's going to take your AGC probably about 5 seconds to recover before you're able to hear any kind of background noise. So be very cautious, even with two antennas, that you don't overload the other receiver when the first one is transmitting.
You know, I would think a better solution would be just to put an antenna switch in there and just run a jumper from the antenna switch to your second radio position. That way, when you get ready to go to bed, you just click over to the B position for studio bedroom. And that way, you're on the same antenna with a different radio, and you don't have to worry about blowing another radio up.
Yeah, I think that it's going to have to be an or rather than an and situation. So and won't work. Well, we can dream. That's all right. Thanks, Don, and also Gordo for all the great answers. And George, your comments are always appreciated. And we just love everybody joining into the chat room. Thanks so much, everyone, for joining us tonight. And we'll see you next week on the same Twitch channel next Wednesday night. And take care, everybody. I'll see you on 3847 for the After Show QSO. And have a great evening. Stay warm. K9BIK. I'll be QRT until we get meet on the air.
All right. Good night, Cheryl. Good to see you tonight. And we'll look forward to seeing you again next week. And that does it for this episode of Ham Nation. But before we go, Don, any final parting thoughts?
Yeah. Come on. I've got my shirt on. I've got my beads on. But you may have noticed that Gordon has beads, and I have beads, and Cheryl has beads, and George has no beads. That's because it's embarrassing, but his chickens eat them.
I've got the hat.
They just go, well, yeah, you do have that. You got that going for you, which is nice. 7-3, everybody. Good night from South Mississippi, where it's still Mardi Gras in my head.
Yeah, 7-3, Don. And Gordo, any final parting words of wisdom tonight?
Yeehaw, hee-haw, 73 all. I hear you on 40 and 20.
New sheriff right, in town. New sheriff in town.
Yeah, you got that right.
I feel like Ron Howard's little brother. But anyway, thanks for being with us tonight. Bob will be back next week, and we'll have another great show for you. Check out our nets after the show on 80 meters with Cheryl at 3847. On 40 meters, I believe, will be on 7.278. And tonight, you can meet Steve, who you saw earlier. He's going to be on 14.263, I believe. I believe 268 was busy. Echo Link is star do drop in star, node number 355-800. And D-Star is always reflector 14, module C. 7-3 from Jackson, Mississippi.
Yeah, Mike, I wish I could turn the video off here tonight.